This program is brought to you by Emory University.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Professor Lawrence Spikowski from the University of Chicago. Just before we get started, I would like to thank the Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture for co-sponsoring the event, also the Hightower Fund, and also the Program of Linguistics at Emory, and Susan Tomasi, the director of the program. Department of Music and Art Chair Kevin Carnes, who are all co-sponsoring the event today. Our guest today is Lawrence Spikowski, Professor of Music and Humanities in the Department of Music at the University of Chicago. His research focuses on the application of recent work on cognitive science, the range of problems confronted by music scholars, including the nature of musical grammar, the relationship between music and movement, text-music relations, and the structure of theories of music. He is the author of Conceptualizing Music, Cognitive Structure, which I have to say is one of the most important texts, one of the really life-changing texts any theorist or student of music will read during their career as a researcher. Published in 2002, and the Foundations of Musical Grammar from 2017. He has recently contributed chapters to Music and Consciousness 2, Music, Dance, Sound, and Motion in Contemporary Discourse, and the Routledge Companion to Music Cognition, Music in Time, Phenomenology. Oh, there's more, sorry. Phenomenology, Perception, Performance, and the Oxford Handbook of Topic and Theory. During the 2010-2011, he held a fellowship from the American Council of Learning Societies and was also a Fulbright Visiting Research Chair at McGill University. Everybody, my pleasure to welcome Lawrence Spikowski.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Laura, for the invitation to come here, for everyone for sponsoring this. I was just checking with Jason the last time I was back at Emory, and it turns out it was like 13 years ago, so it's been a little while. A few buildings have gone up in that time, it's wonderful to be back here and have a chance to talk about some of my recent thinking and even future thinking, which is what I would like to do today. I am also thankful to the tech people for getting the sound working, because it isn't just that I'm a music nerd and I need to have some sound or else I'm not happy. It's actually kind of crucial to some of the points that I want to make. There was an old joke told many years ago about about scholarly music studies, which was told about the Harvard Department of Music, which was, yes, music should be seen and not heard. But the fact of the matter is I had to convince one of the Dean of Humanities some years ago when I was chair of the Department of Music. Music is a kind of scholarship that actually demands a certain kind of engagement with the actual material you're working with. As I ultimately was able to convince her, it's a kind of form of enactive scholarship to a certain extent. And I just draw parallels. You can be a marvelous, these days at least, you can be a marvelous scholar of art history and not really be able to paint. You can be a famous scholar of literature and never have written a short story. But to be a scholar of music and to never have gotten your fingers dirty with the music, you're really at an enormous disadvantage. And so part of what I am talking about today does demand the sound. Let's just hope it keeps working, because singing some of this stuff is not going to be easy. So let's get going then. In my paper today, I'd like to explore the relationship between music and the emotions. This relationship is often taken to be simple and immediate, but I would like to propose that it is instead quite complicated and thoroughly mediated. It'll help to have a musical example ready to hand, and today I would like to focus on the second movement of Samuel Barber's string quartet, Opus 11, which was written in 1936. The movement as a whole is long, a bit over 8 minutes in performance, and so I will only be able to touch on a few of the significant moments of the work. To provide a bit of context for the movement, let me play an excerpt that begins with the conclusion of the first movement, which is marked molto allegro e appassionato, very fast and passionate. This will be followed by the opening minute of the second movement, which is marked molto adagio, very slowly. The contrast between the two movements will bring into relief many of the features of the slow movement that I want to discuss, and will also give you a somewhat better sense of Barber's musical language as a whole. This recording by the Chester String Quartet is from 1990. So now, empirical research begins. Will this play? Again, my focus here will be on the slow movement, which, as you heard, opens with a gently meandering melody in the first violin, accompanied by sustained chords provided by the other members of the quartet. There are two long phrases, the second of which seems to respond to the first. In both phrases, the accompanying strings are coordinated with the violin's line, supporting it and, to an extent, commenting on it through the kind of support they give. The whole is performed at a subdued dynamic, the sounds of the strings blending together, especially at points of arrival, into one homogeneous whole. The effect, especially after the conclusion of the rather boisterous first movement, is soothing and reflective, but also, perhaps because of that long line in the first violin, very focused. And Barber seems to have known he got this movement right from early on. In a letter from September of 1936 to Orlando Cole, one of the founding members of the Curtis Quartet, the ensemble Barber had in mind when he wrote the piece, Barber wrote, "I have just finished the slow movement of my quartet today. It is a knockout." There are a number of reasons this is such a successful movement. Prominent among them is that meandering melody in the first violin. After the tumult and at times confusion of the first movement, the melody set out in the molto adagio offers evidence that the hustle and bustle are not the only ways to achieve forward motion. To be sure, the path the violin traces does not always have a clear goal. Although smooth stepwise motion dominates, the path doubles back on itself with pauses to reconsider the steps taken and what these might bode for the future. Such an image was one reason Matthew Bailey Shea, in a 2012 essay on the quartet, suggested that the violin's melody could be thought of as representing an intentional agent. For Bailey Shea, the agent implied by the first violin's melody was one who moved with a labored physical effort and who was able to achieve the goal toward which such efforts seemed to strive, and who was unable to achieve the goal toward which such efforts seemed to strive. For example, immediately after the music we heard a moment ago, you will advance. Thank you. Immediately after the music we heard a moment ago, which set out the opening section of the slow movement, the violin restates the opening melody, but this time culminating in an evocative tritone leap. You will move. Thank you. Culminating in an evocative tritone leap. Intervals like this, especially within the general tonal context Barber established in the preceding measures, cry out for a resolution of both their constituent pitches. The C, acting as a local leading tone, should proceed upwards to D flat, and the G flat should proceed downwards to F. As if to underscore this tonally charged moment, immediately after the first violin has made the leap up to G-flat, the second violin makes an even larger leap, an octave from C4 to C5, bringing the local leading tone to even greater prominence. But while the G-flat does resolve down to F, the C fails to resolve, sinking instead to a C-flat. The C, as a local leading tone, does eventually resolve to D-flat through a contrapuntal cadence in measures 14 and 15, prompting Bailey Shea to observe, "This is, without question, the most positive event in the entire adagio movement. It is the only real resolution of leading tone energy and, more importantly, the only strong acquisition of the major mode." This achievement is, however, short-lived, for the passage that follows brings us back to B-flat minor by way of a plagal cadence. The arrival on B-flat minor in bar 19 is, indeed, the only cadence on the putative tonic in the entire movement, and occurs a bit more than 2 minutes in. Here's what this passage sounds like. Well, there is much more to be said for thinking of the slow movement in terms of the actions of an intentional agent. Note that the passage we just considered complicates that interpretation a bit. Although the first violin again leads things off, the second violin asserts a certain amount of agency with that remarkable leap from C4 to C5, and motion into both cadences is strongly facilitated by the viola taking over the regular stepwise melody from the first violin. A straightforward interpretation of the first violin as an agent moving with labored physical effort would have to recognize this distribution of agency across the different members of the quartet, a point to which I will want to return a bit later. Because it will be important for some of the issues about music and language and the language of emotions that I want to raise today, we need to follow the path of the molto adagio in the years that followed the premiere of the entire quartet in 1937. Late that year, the famed conductor Arturo Toscanini asked Barber if he could provide a couple of short compositions that Toscanini could perform with an orchestra that had been created expressly for him, the newly formed National Broadcasting Company Orchestra. This request was, of course, a huge boost for a young, comparatively unknown composer like Barber, but it was also a boost for American music, for American composers. In 1938, Barber provided It was a huge boost for American music. Read the text, Larry. For Toscanini had rarely programmed compositions by American composers. Somewhere in there was a sentence. In 1938, Barber provided Toscanini with two scores, one of which was an arrangement of the Molto Adagio for String Orchestra. This came to be known as the Adagio for Strings. The work was premiered and broadcast to the nation on a Saturday evening concert on November 5, 1938. Writing the following day in the New York Times, the critic Olin Downs praised the work for its directness and clarity, writing, "A long line in the adagio is well sustained. There is an arch of melody and form. The composition is most simple at the climaxes when it develops that the simplest chord or figure is the one most significant." That is because we have here honest music by a musician not striving for a pretentious effect, not behaving as a writer would who, having a clear, short, popular word handy for his purpose, got the dictionary and fished out a long one. This is the product of a musical creative nature and an earnest student who leaves nothing undone to achieve something as perfect in mass and detail as his craftsmanship permits. Despite this positive initial reception of the Adagio for Strings, the work reignited a controversy about American music and modern composition. As Barbara Heyman notes in her biography of Barber, the previous decades had borne witness to a conscious effort on the part of native composers to write music that could be identified as American. Toscanini's decision to choose as his representative of American music a composer who had not been part of those efforts was thus seen as a regression. In a letter to the New York Times that appeared a week after Down's review was published, Ashley Pettis observed, "There are important American composers and important American compositions of every type of thought and tendency, but from at least one listener's point of view, neither Mr. Barber nor his works may be justly so termed. One listened in vain for evidences of youthful vigor, freshness, or fire, for use of a contemporary idiom, which was characteristic of every composer whose works have withstood the vicissitudes of time. Mr. Barber's was authentic, dull, serious music, utterly anachronistic to the utterance of a young man of 28, A.D. 1938. The longer history of the Adagio for Strings, however, is a rather more complicated story, one that goes far beyond whether critics reckoned it to be a worthy representative of all that American music might hope for in the 20th century. As Luke Howard, in his exhaustive and quite entertaining survey of this history, relates, the work came to be received in a very different way after it was used in association with broadcast announcements of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's sudden death on April 12, 1945. Radio engineers in Chicago and New York, searching for appropriate music to mark this solemn moment, came upon a recording of Barber's Adagio for Strings that Toscanini and the NBC Symphony had made in 1942, and deemed slow music by an American composer to be an appropriate choice. Others agreed, and the recording was broadcast repeatedly in the days that followed. The association of the Adagio for Strings with solemn memorial occasions seemed to take hold almost immediately, but this was not the only reason for its popularity. Harold Rawlinson, as part of a survey of famous works for string orchestra that he published in the Strad in 1950, noted four important factors. The music is sincere and deeply felt, simple and direct in its appeal. It was broadcast to the world as a tribute to Franklin Delano Roosevelt at a time when our emotions were charged with intensity. The sudden death of the American president stunned millions, and the music found the listener's heart open to receive its message of sympathy. Technically, the Adagio is only moderately difficult, and it is grateful to play. The melodic line is allotted to all sections of the orchestra in turn, and each player can sing his part and feel he is supported by a restful and satisfying harmonic structure. Interest in the music is thus stimulated. The work is in print, and score and parts can be purchased at a reasonable price. This last point was particularly important for Rawlinson, which is why he rendered it in italics. Having the score and parts available at a reasonable price was necessary if orchestra culture was to thrive, for it obviated the need to rent these each time a work was to be performed. What is particularly remarkable, however, is that as the Adagio for Strings came to be used in further memorial services in the coming years, it came to represent not simply music that is sincere and deeply felt, simple and direct in its appeal, but sad music. Indeed, the title of a fairly recent book by Thomas Larson that reflects on both the Adagio for Strings and the place it holds in his life is "The Saddest Music Ever Written." There is certainly more to be said about the various ways the Adagio for Strings has been used across a wide range of media in recent years. Indeed, its use in Oliver Stone's 1986 movie Platoon is a touchstone in practically every recent commentary on the work. But I am most interested in the notion that Barber's composition is now simply sad music. As near as we can tell, it was not initially received as sad music. And indeed, this characterization played no part in my description of its opening moments, nor in those aspects of Bailey Shea's analysis that I discussed. And yet, among researchers in music psychology who are interested in connections between music and emotion, as well as the general public, Barber's Adagio for Strings has become the poster child for sad music. In what follows, I would like to explore the connection between music and the emotions in a bit more detail. Indeed, music has often been characterized as the language of emotions. That is one reason for my invocation of the language of emotions in my title. But another reason is my interest in the language we use to characterize emotions. In the first section that follows, I want to touch very lightly on recent research on the emotions. This will provide a helpful frame for the next section, in which I will turn to some of the work that has been done on music and the emotions. In the third section that follows, I shall briefly explore humans' capacity for analogy, with the idea that analogy can explain why a work like Barber's Adagio for Strings comes to be so associated with sadness, its use in memorial services notwithstanding. An important part of this explanation will be provided by Lawrence Barcelew's perceptual symbol systems theory. Of course, Larry worked for many years at Emory, and I imagine that his work will be quite familiar to you, some of you. My use of it to explain music and emotion may, however, be somewhat novel. By way of conclusion, I want to return to Barber's Molto Adagio, that is the version from the string quartet, to consider in a bit more detail how music works the magic that it does. Although interest in the emotions and their part in human life goes back to antiquity, and although empirical research on the emotions runs parallel to the emergence of the discipline of psychology, investigations into the emotions took on new energy in the early 1980s through a debate about what constituted an emotional response. In a paper published in 1980, the social psychologist Robert Zients presented evidence which suggested that effectual responses could operate below the level of conscious attention. Such evidence flew in the face of theories of the emotions developed since the 1960s, which held that emotions were always the result of some process of appraisal. As the clinical psychologist Richard Lazarus put it in a 1982 response to Zients' article, the role of the emotions is to mediate the relationship between the person and the environment. The appraisal process gives rise to a particular emotion with greater or lesser intensity depending on how the relationship is evaluated with respect to the person's well-being. For most psychologists who did research on emotion, there was simply no emotion without some sort of appraisal. A slightly different approach to the issues raised by the colloquy between Zients and Lazarus involved the notion that human emotional life was organized around a limited number of basic or primary emotions that are not a product of appraisal. Although the size and membership of this category varies, a list offered by Paul Ekman may be taken as typical, and includes anger, fear, sadness, enjoyment, disgust, and surprise. Basic emotions are thought to be distinguished from one another by distinctive patterns of physiological and psychological responses. In recent years, there has been a healthy debate about whether such patterns actually exist and whether they demarcate distinct emotion states. The idea of basic emotions has nonetheless been persuasive to many, not least because it conforms with the hypothesis that emotions are evolutionary adaptations shared by members of a species. Basic emotions are thus thought to be products of innate systems that are in some measure independent from social or cultural learning. These are just a few of the issues that emerged in the veritable explosion of research on emotion that has occurred since Zients and Lazarus's debate. As the psychologist Klaus Scherer suggested in a review of psychological models of emotion, however, by the end of the 20th century, research had begun to converge around a few key points. Emotions are now construed as episodic and processual. Some event, which may be external or internal to the organism, triggers a noticeable change in the way the organism functions. This change in function is thought to have a number of components, including what has come to be called the response triad of emotion. Physiological arousal, for instance, changes in respiration and temperature sensation, motor expression, as evidenced by the facial expressions studied by Paul Ekman and others, and subjective feeling. Drawing together these ideas, Scherer offered this definition. Emotions are episodes of coordinated changes in several components, including at least neurophysiological activation, motor expression, and subjective feeling, but possibly also action tendencies and cognitive processes in response to external or internal events of major significance to the organism. In his review, Scherer also pointed out that the term emotion tended to be used rather indiscriminately. That is, differences in the duration of emotion episodes and the interaction among various response components are such that to use one term for the entire range of effectual responses is, at best, misleading. Scherer suggests that it would be better to distinguish between emotions and other affective phenomena on the basis of factors, such as the intensity and duration of the response and its significance for the organism's interaction with its environment. Under this analysis, emotions are intense phenomena of a relatively short duration in which the changes among response components are tightly synchronized, and in which the organism is focused on the triggering event and its consequences for behavior. Moods, by contrast, are somewhat less intense phenomena with a noticeably longer duration, but with less synchronization among response components, and in which the organism is less focused on the triggering event and its consequences for behavior. The goal of Scherer's detailed taxonomy of affective phenomena was both to focus research and to understand the limits of emotion theories. The diffuse preferences upon which Zients's 1980 study focused are thus regarded by Scherer as affective phenomena different in kind and function from the emotions with which Lazarus was concerned in his 1982 response. With these thoughts about research on emotions in mind, let me now turn to research on music and emotions. In a focus piece published in Behavioral and Brain Sciences about 10 years ago, Patrick Uslin and Daniel Westphal observed that studies of music and emotion have been conducted since the birth of psychology in the late 19th century, and there are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of them. I do not think it can be said, however, that this wealth of studies has clarified the relationship between music and the emotions in any definitive way. It also cannot be said that research on human emotions over the past few decades has shaped the focus and methodology of recent studies of musical emotion. By way of example, let me turn to research on music and basic emotions, which will have a direct bearing on the emotional responses to Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. The apparent immediacy of emotional responses to music and evidence of general agreement among subjects about the emotions induced by a given musical passage, the notion that we more or less instantly understand Barber's Adagio as sad music, led a number of researchers to the assumption that music can induce basic emotions. Setting aside the issue of whether basic emotions actually exist, there are two fundamental problems with this assumption. First, most of the evidence for the induction of basic emotions by music has come from categorization tasks. For instance, subjects have been asked to sort musical excerpts into categories identified by words used for basic emotions, by movements associated with basic emotions, or by photographs of facial expressions associated with basic emotions. The premise here, as it is in other work on basic emotions, is that subjects' ability to perform such tasks accurately reflects an intuitive grasp of discrete emotion states. A possible complication, however, comes from the research on what Eleanor Roche and others have called the basic level of categorization. The basic level offers a way to optimize informativeness and efficiency. For instance, under most situations, the term we would use to describe either an Irish setter or a dachshund would be dog. Using the term does not mean we fail to appreciate the differences between the two, only that this level of categorization provides the best initial tool for communication. Similarly, we might describe both Dido's last aria from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas and the Marche Funèbre from Chopin's Piano Sonata No. 2 in B-flat minor, Opus 35, as sad, and yet still recognize distinctive differences between the emotional states these works induce. The second fundamental problem associated with applying research on basic emotions to music concerns theoretical framework. If one takes the position that basic emotions reflect evolutionary adaptations, the assumption that music has a special capacity to induce emotions is somewhat gratuitous, given that the timescale for the emergence of such adaptations is several orders of magnitude larger than any proposed for the development of music in this human species. It seems more likely that a broad range of sound stimuli are able to induce basic emotions, stimuli to which our evolutionary ancestors would have been exposed, and that works of music simply recruit aspects of these stimuli. As I noted earlier, evidence for basic emotions is drawn from differential responses of the autonomic nervous system. I know of only two studies that have explored directly physiological responses to environmental sounds and musical passages, and both have shown that there are no substantive differences in the way subjects respond to noise or to music. Put another way, there is at present no evidence that music is no better than a rippling stream or clap of thunder at inducing emotions. So if musical emotions are not basic emotions, what are they? One helpful distinction was offered by Klaus Scherer in his 2004 review of research on emotional responses to music, in which he noted that in most cases an organism's physiological responses to emotional stimuli are adaptive. They help the organism prepare its reaction to the stimuli, and as such are proactive. One way, physiological responses to musical stimuli, by contrast, are rather diffusely reactive and not as highly synchronized across different organismic components as those of more utilitarian emotional responses. One way to account for this difference is through what some music psychologists, drawing on the work of the semiotician Charles Saunders Peirce, have called iconicity, in which musical structures share formal similarities with the structures of expressed or felt emotions. Although the idea that musical structures share formal properties with emotional states has intuitive appeal, there has been as yet no satisfactory explanation for why this should be so, why patterns created through sound should be correlated with patterns created by physiological and psychological processes. I would like to suggest that what is missing is an understanding of analogical processes and an account of how perceptual information is transformed into conceptual knowledge. As Dendra Gentner and her colleagues noted some years ago, the capacity to draw similarities between two situations or things is not unrelated to the capacity to make analogies. Where analogy is different is that it is concerned not simply with correlating elements from one domain with elements in another domain, but with mapping relationships between these domains. It is thus often described as concerned with relations among relations, or second-order relations. Making analogies is something that is virtually effortless for humans. Motivated by this fact, Douglas Hofstadter has argued that analogy, as the means by which concepts are assembled and connected to one another, is at the core of human cognition. At the very least, there is considerable overlap between judgments of similarity, making analogies, and processes of categorization, all of which contribute to the distinctiveness of human intelligence. Perhaps more striking is that the capacity for analogy is apparently unique to our species. I say apparently because at this point we simply don't know as much as we might about the analogical capacities of other species. There is, for instance, research suggesting that chimpanzees can understand the second-order relations basic to analogy, especially for spatial reasoning. There's also evidence that dolphins have the capacity to perform analogical mappings of the sort that are necessary for complex motor mimicry. In this photo, the dolphin Elele is imitating the posture of graduate student Amy Miller. Graduate students, take notice. Elele uses her raised tail as an analog for Amy's raised leg and spreads her pectoral fins as an analog for Amy's outspread arms. It's worth noting that this behavior on the part of the dolphin is spontaneous. It's not trained. This evidence notwithstanding, at present it appears that no other species comes close to making or using analogies with the facility and speed of humans. And this capacity is available from a very early age. Children as young as 10 months are able to solve problems by analogy, and by the age of 3 years, analogical abilities are quite robust. The ability to map systematic structural relationships between disparate domains bears witness to a capacity for abstract thought, for thinking about relations between relations of enormous flexibility and wide application. Analogy has been recognized as a key factor in human creativity and has been linked to the conceptual flights of fancy and processes of meaning construction created through metaphor and metonymy. For my part, I have argued that the conceptual domains involved in such mappings need not be restricted to those involving language, an argument supported by the capacity for analogy demonstrated by primates, dolphins, and prelinguistic children. To probe further into analogy, let me turn to another musical example, one that provides an instance of analogy that operates almost entirely in the musical domain. The example is one of Louis Moreau Gottschalk's most successful compositions, The Banjo, or Le Banjo. Although the work, written during the summer of 1853, certainly capitalized on the craze for the banjo that had developed during the mid-19th century, its success lay in Gottschalk's virtuosic evocation of the musical idioms with which the instrument was associated. Here's a recording of the opening of the work as played by Philip Martin. As you probably heard, Gottschalk evoked the banjo through vigorously syncopated rhythmic figures, which repeat with slight variation every bar, and which were collected into four-bar units that gradually built into larger structures, features typical of the banjo music with which Gottschall and many of his listeners were familiar. Nonetheless, even though there are good reasons to believe that portions of the banjo replicated the performance practice of mid-century banjoists with some fidelity, the fact remains that the piano is not a banjo. To summon the visceral rhythmic presence of the banjo, keeping in mind that the banjo is functionally a drum activated by strings stretched across its surface, Gottschalk reinforces strong beats with notes from the bottom octaves of the piano. As you heard at the conclusion of this excerpt, he eventually introduced a density of texture and range of register that far exceed what is possible on the banjo. And although a staccato articulation is used throughout, even so attenuated, the resonance of the piano far exceeds that of the banjo. In short, the banjo, as played on the piano, is not really a banjo. And yet most listeners can make the connection quite easily, correlating their knowledge of the sound and music of the banjo with Gottschalk's piano showpiece. What Gottschalk has given us, of course, is an artful analog for the sound of the banjo. By exploiting characteristic features of the banjo's sound, the strongly percussive onsets of pitches, their rapid decay, and predominantly low register, together with the deployment of these sounds through specific musical materials, arpeggiated chords arranged in syncopated rhythmic patterns and organized into regularly recurring harmonic patterns, Gottschalk summons a sonic image of the instrument. To explain how piano gets turned into a banjo, as it were, I'd like to turn to Larry Barcelew's perceptual symbol systems theory. Barcelew's theory developed out of his research on processes of categorization and offered a way to explain how perceptual information shapes the cognitive representations that occupy our conscious thought. The theory builds on work done in the neurosciences over the past 20, even 30 years now, which has shown that the perception of a physical entity engages a number of coordinated feature detectors in sensorimotor areas that are relevant to a given perceptual mode. During the visual processing of a banjo, for instance, some neurons will fire in response to the shape of the instrument, others for the surface of the instrument, color and orientation. Similar distributions of activation would occur in other modalities and would be represented in feature maps specific to those modalities. These might represent the instrument if someone had struck its strings, the way it feels when grasped. The way it feels when grasped, both in terms of the sensations given by coming into contact with the wood and metal of the instrument and its considerable weight when lifted. And if you haven't lifted a banjo lately, you should. They are heavy. And introspective states summoned on encountering the instrument, such as memories of a favorite relative who played the banjo or dread at the thought of having to listen to banjo music. Once a pattern becomes active in a feature map, conjunctive neurons in an association area capture the pattern's features for later use. This aspect of Barcelew's account of the processing of perceptual information adopts the theory of convergence zones proposed by Antonio Damasio in the late 1980s. For Damasio, as for Barcelew, perceptual information is recorded first in a fragmentary fashion. The neural records of these fragments are then brought together through the distributed neural structure of the convergence zone, which Damasio describes as an amodal record of the combinatorial arrangements that bound the fragment records as they occurred in experience. There are convergence zones of different orders, for example, those that bind features into entities and those that bind entities into events or sets of events, but all register combinations of components in terms of coincidence or sequence in space and time. Although convergence zones are not linked to any specific modality, their basic components consist in all cases of information gathered from perception. According to Barcelew's theory, the conjunctive neurons in the association area also support a sensory motor reenactment of the original activation pattern. Barcelew sketches the process as follows. Once a set of conjunctive neurons in a convergence zone captures an activation pattern in a feature map, the conjunctive neurons can later reactivate the pattern in the absence of bottom-up sensory stimulation. While remembering a perceived object, for example, conjunctive neurons reenact the sensorimotor states that were active while encoding it. That is, conjunctive neurons in the association area fire to partially reactivate the pattern of sensory stimulation, and then neurons fire in feature maps to reenact the earlier sensory representation. Such reenactments are of necessity only partial and will be tailored to the agent's current context of action. Barcelew called the fragmentary records of neural activation captured in a feature map perceptual symbols, and proposed that cognitive operations that make use of perceptual symbols could represent types and tokens, produce categorical inferences, combine the symbols to produce the hierarchical propositions, and yield abstract concepts. The key to this productivity was a cognitively distributed system that Barcelew called a simulator. which, through the neural reenactment of sensorimotor states, gave rise to concepts. The process involves successive iterations of the storing of sensorimotor information, which will occur as additional instances of the original stimulus are encountered. That is, each successive encounter with different banjos, or with the same banjo under different circumstances, will activate similar states in the feature maps. Similar activations of the feature maps will be captured by similar populations of conjunctive neurons in the association areas. And over time, an integrated multimotor sensorimotor representation of the category will develop. For the category banjo, visual information about the appearance of the instrument is integrated with information about distinctive aspects of its use and performance, auditory information about how it sounds, and introspective information associated with encounters with the instrument. This creates a distributed system through the brain's association and modality-specific areas that establishes the conceptual content for the category. This system, through the reenactment of the sensorimotor states associated with the category banjo, makes possible a simulation of the features of a banjo even when no instrument is present. In consequence, Barsalou calls it a simulator. One aspect of Barsalou's theory that is especially important for understanding analogical mappings between music and other domains is that the configuration of properties and relations encapsulated by the simulator for a category may, under certain circumstances, be applied to a different category, giving rise to analogy. This is just the sort of process on which Gottschalk's The Banjo relies. Listeners who are familiar with the sounds and idioms of 19th century banjo performance can map the configuration of properties and relations for the category banjo music onto passages from Gottschalk's composition in order to make sense of some of its more unusual features. According to Barsalou's theory, then, Gottschalk's musical depiction is effective because listening to the banjo reactivates some of the same neural structure associated with actually listening to banjo music, giving rise to an imperfect but still vivid simulation of that experience. Two important qualifications should be added to this account of the basis for analogical mappings. First, listeners who have never encountered banjo music, whether from the 19th or any other century, would experience no such simulation of actual banjo music when listening to Gottschalk's composition. For such listeners, encountering the banjo might in fact be a way of learning about banjo music. When they heard actual banjo music, they would understand it by reference back to Gottschalk's Opus 15. Second, it should be emphasized that Gottschalk's musical depiction is a dynamic one that unfolds over time. It thus simulates not simply banjo music, but the performance of banjo music. Again, there could be no such simulation in listeners not familiar with banjo music, but such listeners could equally correlate Gottschalk's music with any number of dynamic processes, including types of movement or particular emotional states. This last observation points to the relevance of analogy informed by Barsalou's theory of perceptual symbol systems for understanding the relationship between music and emotion. Part of the reason we characterize certain pieces of music as sad is because listening to such music reactivates some of the neural structure associated with feeling emotions related to sadness. The result is a simulation of sadness, in Scherer's terms, an effectual response that is not proactive, but diffusely reactive. I would now like to step back and draw together some of the different threads of my argument. First, human emotions are quite complex and involve coordinated physiological and psychological responses to external or internal events. Music, external or internal, can certainly count as such an event, but so can many other things. The physiological and psychological responses that typify emotions are also very fluid. Although we might talk about an emotional state like sadness, in truth, emotions are highly dynamic processes that unfold and change over time. The notion that music could provide sonic analogs for the emotions proved important. For my recent work on musical grammar and contributed to the idea that one of the primary functions of music within human cultures is to provide sonic analogs for dynamic processes. The emotions are one sort of dynamic process for which musicians have discovered sonic analogs, but so too are gestures and the pattern movements of dance. When this broad notion of the function of music is put together with the recognizable forms into which musicians fashion sound, the result is a basic model for a construction grammar that is specific to music. Let me see if I can illustrate this idea by returning to the second set of phrases from the opening of Barber's Molto Adagio, the ones I discussed in connection with Matthew Bailey Shea's suggestion that the first violin's melody represented an intentional agent. As Bailey Shea observed, there's a cadence on D-flat major in bar 15, which he believed constituted the most positive event in the entire movement. Cadences, which are formal structures with which music theorists are quite familiar, can serve as analogs for a process of arrival. The arrival on D-flat major that Barber engineers is, however, wonderfully complex. As I already observed, it is set up by the tritone leap in the first violin in measure 11, which, of course, does not resolve properly. Instead, forward motion is momentarily deflected by the fall of C to C-flat, as well as by the interruption of the steady sequence of quarter notes that have characterized the meandering melody. The melodic strand is then taken up by the viola, and as it does so, the cello begins a slow, measured tread through the fifth from A-flat to its ultimate arrival on D-flat. And the first and second violins gradually add their voices, such that just before the arrival on D-flat major, the entire choir of strings is working together to achieve the cadence. This is an exquisite example of cadence as a sonic analog for a process of arrival, not least because that process is so gradual and, after the event, so inevitable. Let me play the recording this passage once more and contrast the arrival on D-flat in bar 15 with the arrival on B-flat minor in bar 19. Sonic analogs for arriving at two very different destinations, and not simply because of their mode. It is, of course, completely possible to hear these sequences of musical sounds as providing sonic analogs for emotion processes. If we do so, we may end up simulating, in Barcelou's sense of the term, an emotion like sadness. For the slow rhythm, the repeated deflections away from obvious harmonic goals, and the muted intensity of the strings all correlate well with negative valence emotions like sadness. But to the extent that we hear the music expressing such emotions, we may also hear it as providing an analog for the actions of an agent, one struggling to make sense of the twists and turns of fate. More abstractly, and this is where I began with my interpretation, we could hear it as tracing paths through a tonal topography. I would not want to rule out any of these possibilities, for I believe that the elegance and craft of Barber's music could support in different ways each interpretation. And this, finally, would be the lesson we could learn about music and the language of emotions. Music can provide a language for the emotions, but it can provide a language, also provide a language, or perhaps better, a mode of communication for much, much more. It does so not because it is an elusive art form that somehow taps into the mystery of emotions, but because it is a fundamental way humans make their worlds meaningful. Thanks. That was, as we say, a lot. And for those of you with specialties in these areas, you'll know I really sprinted through some stuff. But I'm trying to draw some things together. But I'm happy to probe any of these things to the extent that I can further. Yes?
Yeah. Earlier in the talk, you mentioned about the violin line and the viola line.
Mm-hmm.
The viola line took over the kind of melody going up and down frequently,
and this was the point specifically, right?
You said that if we were looking at this about from the perspective that it's about an agent,
mm-hmm.
that we would have to then expand our idea of what that is. Are individual instruments usually, or the melodies or lines for individual instruments usually viewed as like an individual part of the story that the song is creating, or are they put together as one piece?
This depends, and the writing on agencies are quite diverse. I myself have weighed in on this a little bit because quite a few of the analyses of agency have not taken into account any of the work on actual human agency, but instead use the agent as a kind of proxy for someone who acts in some way or another. So Bailey Shea's characterization, sorry to keep flipping back and forth between the score, Bailey Shea's characterization is strongly driven by the opening of the piece, where you can just see that the violin is really the moving part, and the rest of the strings are background. So you really have a figure-ground situation here, the figure of the moving violin line and the ground. And that's very easy, then, to think of in terms of agency. I also wanted to suggest that to the extent we hear this as expressive, someone is expressive rather than simply a situation being expressive, right? And that then supports the notion of agency very strongly. However, and sorry just to flip back, but in a situation like this, though, it gets to be more complicated because we don't just have one instrument that's enacting that sort of thing. And in fact, this is what I have written about in other works about how agency, especially in cases of music, is many times distributed. And this notion of distributed agency is very much related to the work of a marvelous scholar named Edwin Hutchins. His book, Cognition in the Wild, from 1995, is just a marvelous study of how when you're navigating a large naval vessel, that navigation happens with this coordinated activities among as many as 6 different individuals. And they all have their different tasks. They've all got to work together. They've got to do that. So it isn't just the navigator who's navigating the vessel. It's all of these people. And when you read that as a musician, you go, that sounds like ensembles I've been in, you know, that sort of thing. Distributed agency in that fashion has really not been discussed very much within the music literature, to my knowledge. But one thing that I want to point out is, to the extent we hear an agent here, if we really want to dig into it, we need to think of agents and not just one. And also that I think that there's this very interesting connection between agency and expressivity. So when we hear Gottschalk's The Banjo, we don't immediately think of agent unless we're thinking of Philip Martin playing it at the piano, right? And we, even though he's supposed to be evoking a banjoist, it's not the first thing we think of because it's just kind of happy, folksy music, and agency is not necessarily the first thing we come to. Finally, I should say that my own work on agency has been informed a lot by the social anthropologist Alfred Gell's work. He has a marvelous book called Art and Agency, which is really, it's a quite interesting study about how agency actually works. And Gell advances the notion that there's primary and secondary agency. So the primary agent would be Samuel Barber writing this, and the secondary agent is actually then the composition, which takes his agency and puts it out into the world. That's a rough equation of what Gell is talking about. Long answer to a short question. Yes.
So maybe,
yes, Laura.
Speaking of also metaphors and narratives, this agency is probably more prominent in a genre like a string quartet, which perhaps has this tradition, and especially the turn of the 20th century when you get to like Charles Ives,
mm-hmm.
who describes quartet as four characters who argue and fight and
mm-hmm.
communicate.
Mm-hmm.
So we can, and just historically, the genre has been one composer turned it for their most expressive and experimental works
mm-hmm.
from the 17th century on. So maybe this kind of agency is more prominent in a genre like a string quartet.
It can be, although the discourse on agency has tended to focus around chamber music many times, but it's tended to focus around the question of, you know, where the agent is. Oddly enough, in Ed Klorman's recent book, Mozart's Music of Friends, agency factors very strongly within that. But Ed mostly talks about the string quartet the way he'd talk about an ensemble of opera performers. And in fact, he draws that connection quite specifically. So now we have the weeping first violin, and then comes the supportive second violin coming in that way. I've kind of pushed up against that work myself because I think it can put us at a distance from the music. In other words, Barber's the one who's engineering these sorts of things here. And the way he's engineering it is actually the way he's writing the sequence of sounds. So, yes, there is a real first violinist on this recording who is playing that particular music. But to the extent that as we're hearing the music, we imagine this more diffuse agent who's not necessarily that person, so to speak, I want to think about how it is that the musical materials are actually creating that character rather than simply saying it's the first violinist. But it does seem that there is a pretty vibrant exchange around ensemble music, although Seth Monahan, when he talks about this, is really talking more about music theorists and their agency. So that's yet another story. Yes?
This is more a question about history and memory than it is about music.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite struck by your comment that the adagio for strings, this movement of the quartet, was not associated with sadness until 1945.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm wondering is, have you heard the actual broadcasts, recordings of the broadcasts of Roosevelt's death, and what role, when did the music occur? Did it occur before, afterward, or during?
Yes, okay.
The reason I'm asking is, I suspect there's an event for many Americans at that time that ended up producing so-called flashbulb memories.
Mm-hmm.
But so far as I know, there's no studies about what music you were hearing at the moment.
Right. According to the account of this that I have read, and I'm trying to remember the exact source, I think this is actually in Thomas Larson's book, The Saddest Music Ever Written. He gives the closest reading of those that series of events. And what happened was FDR was down in... down here, was down here, and he suddenly had a cerebral hemorrhage at my age. Anyway, he had a cerebral hemorrhage and died quite suddenly and quite unexpectedly. Now, in retrospect, people are saying, oh, he was looking pretty frail before that time, but no one was expecting this to happen. Truman gets, Eleanor Roosevelt gets the call. She informs Truman of what's happening. And she reminds Truman at that point that he is now president, and this is actually the way, at least in my limited understanding, how it works. In other words, yes, he has to take the oath of office, but when the president dies, the vice president is then president at that point. The announcement is made at 7 o'clock that evening on April 12th, is made that evening. Broadcasters are then looking for some music to play. And they, according to the story that Larson tells, find this 78 that Toscanini had recorded. And the important things are, this is slow music, they can see it's adagio, and it's by an American composer. Let's put it on. And it was really, really that simple. Now, the thing is that this story gets, and this is more in Luke Howard's essay, you find it out. A very similar thing happened when JFK was assassinated, to the extent that, once again, broadcasters were looking for sad music to play. Now, that's 1963, so it's almost 20 years after. In the intervening period of time, Barber's Adagio strings have been used for a number of other important memorial services at that time. So it was not so unnatural for broadcasters to choose it at that point. But at the point that the announcement was actually made, the music that was put on was at the wrong speed. And so that got goofed up. They then tried to play a different version or a different recording. That music got goofed up, and they ultimately just ended up playing patriotic music at that time. So people remember the music being associated with the JFK assassination, but actually at the point of the broadcast, it wasn't. It was a failure at that point. And so this is, of course, the problem with flashbulb memories, is that at least when I read Alison Winter's work on this, a lot of it is reconstructed after the fact, so to speak. Then meaning that hearing Barber's Adagio for strings associated with the announcement of JFK's death is a reconstruction of events at that point. There's also a story told that the Adagio for Strings was played at Roosevelt's funeral, but it was not. Eleanor Roosevelt did not have music at the funeral, and it was a very small private affair. So, you know, that doesn't happen. So it gets to be a little bit of a myth about the Adagio for Strings to a certain extent. That takes nothing away from the main point that I think you were drawing out, which is that this is a moment where the nation is completely shocked, and this music is then coming into it, and the two are fusing. And that's, in fact, I think what Rawlingson brings out in his thing about the Strad. He's writing that only 5 years afterwards, and he says this music landed at this moment, which had an impact on millions, as he put it. But it's a very good question, and I go back and forth because I listen to the music and I go, yeah, I can understand why somebody would say that's sad, but that's not how it was received for at least almost the first decade after it was written, at least in the critical reviews, which I've given just a sample of, but all the other ones pretty much fall in line with this.
Yeah. If I might, I mean, the impact is so striking because, of course, for our generation, mm-hmm. it was that scene in Platoon that you're talking about.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's one of the most memorable scenes I've ever mm-hmm. seen in a movie.
Yeah. Yes.
But, you know, if it's associated with a widespread flashbulb memory, the notion that its mm-hmm. profile, so to speak, with the public would have been just transformed instantaneously and persist mm-hmm. is not shocking.
Yeah, yeah. Luke Howard's essay on this in American Music is quite striking because it turns out that the music, Platoon, is very important, but this particular music has then been repurposed in many different ways. For instance, there's an episode of South Park in which the Adagio for Strings plays a part. There is it was used as a version, as a basis for a version of electronic dance music by a group in the UK. It is now at the point where it has jumped the shark to some extent in that, and is now can be used. Ironically, it can be extracted out of that. And that is also, I think, a very interesting moment. In other words, that this thing now just becomes a kind of artifact that we move around. And in my terms of it being a sonic analog, it's evacuated of that. It is now just a kind of thing that's there. And so with this notion of a sonic analog, that's why I wanted to play as much of the music as I could fit in here, to really get the sense of this music pulling you along in that way, rather than, oh, yeah, the barber, yeah, and then, you know, you kind of tune out. Other questions? I answered. Oh, no, good. Yes.
Do you think, at least here, that it's significant that, like, an anthropomorphic quality is assigned to the music when it's negatively balanced? Or do you think in your research that it's kind of broadly can be associated anthropomorphically?
Anthropomorphically?
Yeah.
Yeah, the anthropomorphic element. Anthropomorphism gets to be pretty slippery because in the my first book, which Laura so graciously mentioned, I talk about Donald Tovey's analysis of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, right? And he's really talking about the first movement, for the most part, F major, not this stuff. It's pretty positive, pretty happy music. And he characterizes this as the movements of a colossus in some way or another. So the anthropomorphism is sort of filtered through a couple of levels. But for Tovey, he can clearly hear that music as being about some being, some person in that way. The Mozart Jupiter Symphony has its name from the notion that especially the first movement are like Jove striking something, you know, in that way. So I think that our connection between negative valence music and expressivity, I think that makes the anthropomorphic mapping readier and easier. But the fact is, as humans can see faces in clouds, and they could, you know, and they can see humans in all sorts of places. Try hard enough, and each of these chairs will become someone you know. I can't unthink that now. Anyway, but the thing is that you're right in that I think there's a quicker mapping between this expressive music and music that's just jubilant or buoyant or that's that kind of thing. And just finishing this up, some years ago I was working with a young scholar who's from Germany, and he was interested in late 19th and early 20th century Lieder, by a lot of composers that most of us have never heard of, I'd never heard of, but enormous amount of songs written at that time, really quite interesting. He was really struck by how much this music was about being expressive. You know, that was really what the genre of the Lieder and the composers he was studying was about. And so we actually kind of came up with a model for design principles for expressive music. In other words, if you want expressive music, there's certain things you do. It's not going to be snappy tempos, right? It's going to be more middle register, but then you pop up into the high register. Subdued dynamics, but you can get loud. But you get, in other words, there's a way that you can design it, meaning that there's ways you can design non-expressive music if you, you know, take out a bunch of those factors. And there should be scare quotes around each of those. In other words, non-expressive music is certainly expressive of non-expressivity. But anyway, but the thing is that your point, I think, is actually a really good one about how easy it is to make these mappings or how difficult. They also tend to be historically contingent. They're more popular at certain periods than at others. And that's why quite a few of the works from the early 19th century, Beethoven especially, get names put onto them of one sort or another. Any other questions? I got away with running roughshod over Larry's work. Okay, it's really like, and here's perceptual symbols. Again, I'm appropriating parts of it. It has been, for me, it's been really useful. I got to know Larry when he was actually at the University of Chicago back in the 90s, and I've been following his work, and it's just been really useful for what I need to think about. Again, very instructive. If you happen to be at all interested in this, available in many fine libraries in my second book, I actually talk about that and build out some of the things, and all the references are in there, because this was really a pretty quick sprint through things. And that has an example of a hummingbird, which is much nicer. So.
Okay, then. That was a fascinating talk. That was inspiring. Well, let's thank Larry Spivak. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was really such a pleasure to have you here at Emory. And again, thanks one more time. Thank you all for coming. And thank you again, CNBC, Hightower, and the Program of Linguistics. And Music Department. I keep forgetting my Music Department. The Music Department. Thank you all for coming. And we'll be here for a few more minutes if you want to chat one-on-one with Larry. He will be here. Okay, great. Thank you.